I was so taken with the first version of the squash story. The magic beans version of the story. The miraculous uncovering. There's no ambiguity. It's just this gift from the past that we couldn't possibly deserve, but we receive it anyway. That, of course, is grace. And the teller of the second story emphasized in their telling of the story that what happens in that story, the people tending the same squash for generations, is maybe even more miraculous. Maybe even more of a gift that people were that steadfast about tending this one squash, this thing that they understood to be an essential part of life. That is the works that Barbara talked about. And so we then receive a gift that is generation after generation carrying a living gift forward. That amount of dedication by people is truly maybe more stunning. But then there's a third version of the story. After that second version, someone from the Menominee people of Wisconsin said this. Yes, the Mennonite University says the seeds are there and they can't see a basis for a story that they would have been found in a clay ball, that there's no evidence of that being true. And you don't know where that part of the story came from, that it's really just a kind of a wild tale. But in fact, there are a lot of public records showing that these clay balls have been discovered and that a number of them have been taken from native burial grounds, some of them by archaeologists, some of them not by archaeologists, so we don't know who took them and who has them. This is known partially because some of those clay balls have recently been repatriated. So the idea that one of these vessels containing seeds might have sort of gotten out and gotten loose in the world is really not a strange story, not something that would be made up at all. They were a common part of burial mounds. So this man says that, in fact, there's nothing in the original story which is surprising or unfounded, and that, in fact, the Menominee people might not be quick to share the story in a very public way because they've learned that sometimes encounters with the dominant culture that landed here in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, things don't always go that well for their stories when they share them. So they tend to sort of keep them to themselves. And they're not as worried about whether the dominant culture feels like there's proof for the story. So basically he said, it might have happened the way the first version of the story tells it. It might not have. You're outside of that story, so you may never know how that story goes. And the ambiguity in the telling of the story, well, there's a difficult truth for those of us who do come from that European heritage to grapple with. And there's an ambiguity about that that shows up everywhere in our lives. If you are a parent and you have ever navigated a sibling dispute, you have dealt with this ambiguity. There's this version of the story, and there's this version of the story, and you're never going to know. Certainly, it comes up in legal disputes. And I saw a piece this week about police body cameras. It was a series of short videos in which they showed a story from the perspective of the policeman, from the perspective of the dashboard camera, and from the perspective of a bystander. And then they ran through the scenario three different times, and then they asked you, after you viewed each version of it, to respond about how threatening the situation might be. And the first one, it looks like the policeman and this suspect are having a terrible fight, that the police person is being assaulted. And then you get it from a different view and you realize that they're actually doing a complicated set of dance moves, that there's actually no threat in the situation at all. But from the perspective of right here, it looks terribly threatening. Well, that one happened, they set that one up just to show, to put you in the mindset of, from where you stand in a story, you just can't always know. And then they go through a series of more typical policing scenarios that don't involve any dancing. And ask you to see if you can figure out what's actually happening in this story. And sometimes none of the perspectives available on video actually reveal what happened. Now, they didn't set this up in order to say we shouldn't have any cameras because it's not helping. They set this up to say we always want to know what the truth is. And sometimes it's hard to see it. It's hard to find it. And there are a number of statistics out there now that say that police wearing body cameras are actually much less likely to use force. And so whatever is revealed on the video may be less important than the fact that there's someone with them in a different way. So again, the point of both this exercise that I encountered, in which we watched these policing scenarios, and how that plays out, it's not about don't try to find the story. It's about knowing that landing on certainty may be more difficult than we want it to be. So I've gotten us to the not particularly helpful spot of, well, you can't ever really know anything at all. So we'll just sit here, because we don't know and we can't know, and it's not ours to know anyway, and we just have to leave it alone. Or we can decide, in fact, that this leaves us some open space to figure out a new way of going about things. We don't have to focus on making sure that we have it exactly right all the time. There are lots of places in the world where it's important to get it exactly right. And I think in church life and in spiritual life, this is the place where we work with that uncertainty, that open space. We can hear it when we experience the story of the squashes. The fruit of the story is real. There is a big squash, and it is old. It is a rare variety, and it clearly has an ancient heritage. The passing of those seeds is a sacred act, whether they were left underground and found later, or whether they were passed hand to hand above ground. There are many stories, perhaps most, when we have to accept that the fullness of the story is not ours, and we will never fully know it, and yet we still participate in the story. We almost all eat squash, and so that heritage of being a people who eat squash and understand what that means for life is part of our story, no matter who we are. And human society is comprised of telling stories, of listening to each other's stories, of understanding that each person has their own set of stories to tell. And almost all of our religions are built around the telling of a set of stories. It is the telling of our stories that makes us whole. Last week, I talked about the work of living in the balance of compassion and the insight that everything is interconnected and interdependent, and that our work in the world is to move between those two things, to remember to have compassion and then to remember that everything is connected and interdependent. So those three versions of the squash story hold that interdependence, that the squash is passed through time, that this is one of those things that holds people through the centuries and across cultures, even if there are particular parts of the story that may not be known to us. The telling and the retelling of all of the versions of that story call out our compassion in the different possible pasts. We can see the longing for connection to the past, the longing for a strong lineage that can maintain a certain line of seeds, the longing to be connected to each other and whole, even though we have struggled as humans to do that. In the thrice told story, we hear the story of oppression and of how people find themselves again after having had much taken. All of this can make someone hearing all three versions of the story ache for the world, ache for our own longings, recognize, as I said, our hope for there to be some magic beans somewhere that will just make it all whole again without us having to figure it out. And that is the work of compassion. And as I said last week, that can burn you out. And so you have to move back to that larger perspective of how things are interconnected. We live in a culture that values certainty, that values knowing for sure how things will play out or how we can line up the pieces. And the reality is we have to find ways to be at ease with not knowing, with making choices and stepping into our lives not knowing for sure how it will play out. And our minds tend to run ahead and try to create a future that will be the one. Well, maybe it will go like this. Well, maybe we can go. Well, if I just like, if I. And the work is to know that you'd never know the whole story. There's always a piece that you can't know that maybe isn't yours to know. And still, we have to make our choices and step into our futures. And it may be true that out there in the Midwest, some people are right now planning their planting season with rows of this ancient squash. They are imagining them blooming under the summer sun. Maybe they are indeed putting them in their seed trays. And there is the past taking root again, and we never know if there will be a hailstorm out there. We don't know exactly how this squash came to be in this present moment. What we can tell for sure about it is if the seed was tended by the Miami people and hand-pollinated for hundreds or maybe thousands of years. That's an interesting thing to try to comprehend, isn't it? Squash being passed down for thousands of years. If it was hand-pollinated for that long or grown for that long, then it was passed down with love from 7 generations, 14 generations, 28 generations. And if it turns out that, in fact, the seed did come from a clay ball buried 800 years ago, then it was still passed down with great love from 7 generations, 14 generations, 28 generations. So what we can hold on to for sure in all of the complexity of these stories about the squash is that this is the through line of an essential source of life. Someone came into the sanctuary this morning holding an egg carton with a dozen eggs, which I'm going to assume were laid by chickens in your yard. This is one of the gifts of the Go Local movement that we are experiencing pretty strongly in our area. That there is a very simple and essential heritage that we can reclaim, even if we can't understand the full complexity of the story. It is also one of the gifts that people who are thinking ahead into the lives that we will live when there is a lot less oil in our world and we have to completely reshape how we live our lives, they are also connected to this Go Local movement and thinking about how do we pass on some of these fundamental gifts of life, the seeds that sustain us, whether they are literal seeds or metaphoric seeds, the process of creating and sustaining food. And so we begin to see the holiness of the most simple things again. We begin to imagine ourselves as a people who will pass on gifts, seeds, stories. And even if we don't know how it will play out, we can begin to make choices about what we will pass on, what we will choose to pass on. So here is what we know about how we will pass on what we think makes for wholeness in the world. It will not be a single story. It will be a story told many different ways. And sometimes the stories will contradict each other, or at least seem to when we're in the middle of them. And that occasionally we'll be able to pull back and see the wholeness of the stories. But mostly we will just pass on something that we know is complicated and is our best guess. And some of the most fragile seeming vessels can carry life forward. Steady attention, simple clay bowls, the soil under your feet.